I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. As millions of Americans scramble to get their chance at a COVID-19 vaccine, the state of California remains a hotspot of coronavirus infections, with more than 3 million residents infected with the virus. And while the state has managed to slow the death toll, Latino residents remain some of the worst affected. In fact, data shows that some Latino neighborhoods have roughly 5 times as many cases of COVID-19 than richer, whiter communities. And the death rate among Latinos in L.A. has surpassed that of all other racial and ethnic groups. Here to help us understand why is Brittany Mejia, Metro reporter with the L.A. Times. Brittany, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how has the Latino community been dealing with COVID-19 in terms of the number of cases right now?
Yeah, it's been pretty dramatic. Like the differences between the groups of people who are getting COVID here, especially if you look just on a more local level here in Los Angeles County, I mean, it's been 1,000% increase in Latino COVID-19 deaths since November here in LA County. And it's kind of the same situation that's playing out across the state. I mean, you have dense housing, crowding living conditions, a higher proportion of essential workers who can't work from home. And this is all contributing to what's going on right now.
You made that link in your reporting between housing conditions for Latinos in Los Angeles and COVID. Give us a little sense of what you meant there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just actually reported a story about a father and his 4 adult children who shared a 1-bedroom apartment in South LA. And that's one of the areas, one of the neighborhoods that is like where 1 in 5 homes is overcrowded. And this is a situation where, you know, rent is too expensive. This family couldn't move out. Like the children couldn't move out on their own. A lot of them were essential workers. And so they were caught in this condition where they couldn't stay home. They slowly each started to get COVID. The dad was the last one who got it. They tried to protect him. They wore masks inside, but he shared the living room with his 2 sons, and he eventually got it, and he actually passed away.
Brittany, I'm sad to hear that you actually have some experience dealing with this firsthand within your own family. Would you tell us a little bit about what your family is facing, being Latinos in that community with COVID-19?
Yeah, it's honestly been so surreal, I think, through this pandemic to kind of see the same situation playing out in my own family. There's been like at least 10 family members who have got tested positive for COVID over the last year. And my uncle actually here in LA County is currently in the ICU on a ventilator because he got COVID. And so seeing it kind of on that level, I often see kind of the same stories, like my family story reflected in the stories I'm telling.
What about the fact that I know here in New York in particular and across the country, I'm sure some of this is true, that a lot of black and brown workers are also essential workers. Is that playing into why the Latino population in Los Angeles is being so disproportionately affected by this?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, if you look at who are essential workers, I mean, 50, at least here, when you look at LA County, 55% of Latinos work in these jobs and 48% of black residents do, compared with 35% of white residents. So you do see that difference. You do see that there is a greater increase in black and brown residents who are going out and doing this essential work.
Brittany, what about undocumented workers? We know that there are many undocumented workers, particularly in California, who are working in the agriculture industry there. How is that community faring?
It's the same kind of impact. It's hitting really hard. I feel like there's maybe a little bit more skepticism about reaching out to the government or reaching out for help in those cases, because I have also seen that in my own reporting, where those who are undocumented are a little bit more reticent, you know, to actually seek out that help, to go get tested. And in some cases, it really is like someone can't afford to miss that work. Someone can't afford to go in and take the time off and stay at home and quarantine. And it really is, you're making a choice between, you know, like you obviously don't want to get everybody sick, but you also have to pay your rent. And so a lot of these community members are faced with a really difficult choice.
What is Gavin Newsom and or other state officials doing? What are they doing to help curb this? We know that the rates of infection and deaths are somewhat going on the decline in LA, but this is a pretty big problem for this particular community.
Right. It's been interesting kind of seeing what's happening at the local level and how this is being addressed, because even county health officials here have called it horrifying and have been basically calling for the government to do more to help essential workers and those living in dense, overcrowded conditions. And I'm often hearing, you know, from epidemiologists that that is who needs to be targeted, is those who are in these multi-generational houses. And you know, and I think that that needs to be the priority. And it's been interesting seeing kind of on the local level, councilmen saying like, we need to go door to door. We need to focus on this community, talking to them about vaccines and not just hoping that they'll get an email or they'll go on Twitter and see this information. Like, we need to actually do this targeting in these communities.
We're going to be talking a lot more about vaccine rollout and distribution across the country. But I'm curious, Brittany, what does vaccine distribution look like in LA right now? Because we're seeing racial and ethnic disparities in some of the cities around the country that are beginning to release this data.
Right. I mean, it's been interesting here. I think last weekend I did a story looking at Keck USC doing vaccinations, and they were vaccinating the family members who are 65 and older of hospital housekeepers. And this whole effort was being done because they saw lagging rates of vaccinations among housekeepers who are predominantly Latino. And I think from there they were like, okay, we need to change the way that we're doing this, and we do need to have this equity going on. If we have like 25% of only of hospital housekeepers getting vaccinated. And so it's been interesting kind of seeing, because you have at the same time, my colleague Julia Wick told a story where people are waiting in standby lines all day to get these to get a vaccination. And these are people who can afford to miss work. And often I don't think that they're Latinos or Black residents who are standing in line all day waiting to get an extra dose.
There's almost an interesting tension, really almost a sad tension here between, you mentioned house cleaners and housekeepers. I'm sure there are many home health aides and care professionals who are also people of color who need to be vaccinated. And we're still seeing that the rates of those vaccinations is very low compared to white, wealthier residents of the area. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, that's what at this point, yes, that is what it seems like. I am going to be curious how there is going to be that move to equity. And I think, I mean, you know, after 65 and older and these other residents, it's been interesting because councilmen here in LA County have expressed their feeling that these vaccinations need to be routed to community clinics, you know, in these communities, like in these communities of color. And so it's interesting kind of seeing that, because a lot of them are saying, I just spoke with a councilman, Gil Cedillo, who is saying, you know, my residents, in some cases, they don't have a car, they don't drive. And how are they going to take the bus to Dodger Stadium and hike up a hill to get vaccinated? I think, and he was basically like, the approach here needs to change.
I think there are a lot of places that are saying the same thing, Brittany. Brittany Mejia is a Metro reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Brittany, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Chaz from Sonoma, California. I'm 70 years old. Our county rollout of vaccines has been a complete fiasco, culminating in the cancellation of appointments that we had been made today. Why? Because we're 65 and older, not 75 and older. It just makes one shake their head at the incompetence. We all knew the vaccines were coming. Why didn't they get this organization stuff set up? Anyway, I'm disgusted and I'm waiting to get an appointment still.
We just heard how Latino communities in LA have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19 as the pandemic continues to reveal inequities in health across the U.S. And now it looks like the rollout of the vaccine itself is reflecting similar problems. So far, of the 17 states that have reported vaccine distribution data by race and ethnicity, communities of color are receiving the vaccine at lower rates than their white peers. I'm joined by Rachel Hardiman of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health to talk about this. Rachel, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So why only 17 states so far having released this data? Shouldn't we be getting this data from every state?
That's a great question, and we absolutely should be getting this data from every state, but right now, not every state is collecting these data and able to report it out. And I think that's part of, you know, the significant problem here is that we don't have a vaccine surveillance system in place at the state level or even nationally at this point to really be tracking what's happening.
Rachel, the big takeaway here, no pun intended, is really, I think that from what we see in the data that's being reflected, and you can sort of definitely tell us what you're seeing here, is that overall, Black and Brown communities, Black and Latino communities have had a disproportionate effect in rates of infection and deaths, and yet they're less likely to get vaccines, at least from this preliminary data, than their white counterparts.
That's exactly right. So we know and we've heard for months now that Black and Brown communities are disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. And now we're seeing the exact same pattern when it comes to vaccine distribution and vaccine uptake. So certainly, and some states are reporting that white people are actually, you know, 2 to 3 times more likely to be vaccinated in comparison to their Black counterparts in the same same communities.
So let's talk about some of the reasons why that is, Rachel. And of course, we know that we're talking about cities like Philadelphia. We're talking about Miami-Dade County. We're talking about here in New York City and even in Washington, D.C., where the percentage of people of color who are being vaccinated are significantly less than those of their white counterparts. Why? Do we have any early indicators as to why? We just heard Brittany Mejia from the L.A. Times talking about maybe transportation to get to vaccine sites is less. But why else? Because I can tell you, I'm trying to get vaccine appointments for my parents, and it is not easy, Rachel.
It is not easy. I had the same struggle a couple weeks ago for my parents as well. And I have to say, I think that we have to be clear that at the root of this issue is systemic and structural inequity and structural racism that we're seeing is the reasons why Black and Brown communities are getting COVID at higher rates. And it's the same reasons why they're not getting access to vaccines. So in some cities and some communities, it's an issue of location. You know, we just heard the story in LA about, you know, vaccine centers being set up in places that are inaccessible to all people. They can't get there or they can't take the time off of work to get there. We also have to, you know, think about, you know, the issues around vaccine hesitancy are certainly there as well. And we haven't really seen any significant efforts yet to really sort of combat those issues in addition to the access issues.
I mean, the access issues, and we're going to talk about this more in the next segment coming up, but the access issues to me, at least here in New York City, were stunning, Rachel. A number of websites, a number of different places to try and sign up, set up accounts. This is for people, particularly the elderly, that can't be an easy thing to do.
That's exactly right. You know, I think we need to think beyond emails and we need to think beyond online signups for vaccines. We need to meet people where they're at. We need to go to their workplaces. We need to go to their neighborhoods and to their homes and really reach out in sort of old school public health fashion to be able to engage community and have discussions and get them vaccinated.
Rachel, We sort of identified the issue here. People of color are being infected and dying at higher rates, and yet they're less likely, at least right now, to have been vaccinated than their white counterparts are. Do we know if there are states that are beginning to try and address this issue?
You know, I'm not sure of specific states yet that are trying to address this issue. I think that there are sort of different community organizations and leaders within different communities that are really working hard to address this issue. You know, Philly, Dr. Stanford is doing some incredible work with her her group to address the issue of vaccine rates in Black communities in Philly. And I think we're going to see, as the alarm has been sounded over the past few days in particular, we're going to see more efforts both at the state and I think at the local level and the national level to really address this issue.
Speaking of the national level, the Biden administration did announce a health equity task force. Is that meant to ensure, would this be maybe one of their first things they're attempting to tackle here?
Absolutely. I would think so. You know, you know, I've heard Dr. Nunez Smith in the past couple of days mention that particularly the data collection piece will be an important priority in her work in leading that group to really ensure that both equity is at the forefront of all of the aspects of what they roll out, but that in particular data collection happens in a timely and efficient manner.
Rachel, what does an equitable rollout of COVID-19 look like, or what should it look like? Because I think, you know, one of the issues here is, at least in New York, is that there are multiple websites. There's a lot of confusion. First of all, we're asking people to sign up at multiple places. And really, it's a question of people who have the time to spend on a website refreshing it for 9 hours straight, the people who have the time to be able to take off of their work and potentially wait on a line. And they seem to be gaming the system a little bit. So what does equitable COVID-19 vaccine distribution look like, particularly for communities of color?
I think that's an excellent question. And, you know, I think Minnesota, where I live, is a perfect example of what, you know, what you have to be thinking about first is that, so for in a state like Minnesota, we have, you know, we've prioritized Minnesotans over the age of 65. But here, what that means is that we are targeting more white Minnesotans because nearly a quarter of white Minnesotans are over the age of 65, but only 6% of Black Minnesotans are over the age of 65. So right from the start, we have failed to sort of take an equity lens. And so I think each state needs to certainly look at their demographics, both overall, but also their demographics with respect to who has been disproportionately, you know, impacted by COVID, and start from there. And then I think the second part has to be that we need to expand our definition of high risk or vulnerable categories to really make sure that essential workers are part of that. So we know that, you know, Black and brown communities and Black and brown people are overrepresented in as essential workers and grocery stores and food production, public transit, you know, janitorial work. And we need to explicitly target those groups, as well as within those groups, targeting folks based on both where they live, you know, if they live in multi-generational housing, as well as by race. And I think it's okay to identify, you know, race and ethnicity as a specific criterion to determine priority for a vaccination.
Rachel, a lot of the COVID-19 responses, at least the, how we've been covering this over the course of the past year, there's been a lot of tension between how the federal government, at least under the Trump administration, was dealing with the states. And then there were state officials having tension with local officials on different rollout, you know, capabilities or testing capabilities, or even directive on what should and shouldn't be closed. Do you suspect that those tensions with the Biden administration's new focus on some sort of health equity will minimize somewhat? Will there be some standardization, I guess, across how we start to look at this? Because it feels like these political battles are playing out. And at the end of the day, people are being left behind.
That's exactly right. You know, politics, you know, from the start has played a significant role in how COVID-19 has been handled. And I do think that, and, you know, of course, I can't speak for the Biden administration, but I do expect and hope that a lot of that will shift as we, you know, center the folks who are the most marginalized and the most impacted by this disease in our efforts to change things.
Rachel Hardiman is a Blue Cross Endowed Professor of Health and Racial Equity at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Charles from Dallas, Texas, commenting on our experience with COVID shots. Initially, we were dismayed by the line of cars that resulted in a 45-minute bottleneck at the entrance to the parking lot. But inside the facility, the process was a model of organization and efficiency. At each step of the process, we were met by engaging, cheerful, knowledgeable helpers who explained instructions clearly, told us what to expect at the next step. It was actually an inspiring community-building experience.
This is Mary Lee Halfley in Fort Worth, Texas. My husband is 76. I am 72. He is in three high-risk categories, in addition to being 76, and we both live in a high-risk zip code. I registered my husband and I on December 30th. Still nothing.
Hey, this is Susie from Bend, Oregon. I work in crisis mental health with the public for the county, and I had the privilege of receiving my first dose of the Moderna vaccine on December 31st, and just had my second dose of the vaccine last week on the 28th. I would say that my experience has been great. Our county seems to be well organized and doing a good job of getting the vaccine out to the public. I wish we could have a little more consistency across the state. My parents live in Umatilla County, and they're older, and one has compromised health, and they don't know when they're going to get the vaccine. So it's unfortunate that your experience with this, accessing it and with the process, seems to be really location dependent.
Hi, my name is Paul. I live in Levittown, Pennsylvania. I have been trying to get an appointment for a COVID-19 vaccination, and it's impossible. I have applied with hospitals, doctor's office, pharmacies, the county, the city. Nothing is giving me anything. I'm 74 years old. I need to get vaccinated to go back to work. Every night I see people on TV getting vaccinated. This is the most frustrating thing.
Hi, my name is Oren, and I've been trying to arrange a vaccine for my 83-year-old aunt who lives in New Mexico. She has diabetes and some other medical conditions. I haven't succeeded in doing that yet. It seems like everything has to be done online, and I think it's just a matter of supply, but it's impossible to tell why I have been able to do it, because you can't actually contact a person. You can only go through the various menus and options on their website.
Hi, I work with adults with special needs. My job called me and asked if I wanted a vaccination. I said, yes, please. The next week, I was given a time and address in Carlsbad. There were no lines. Everybody was masked. There was proper distancing. I had no problems. My name is Robin, and I'm from Oceanside.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
On Monday, the military of Myanmar staged a coup, detaining officials from the government's civilian party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD. Among those detained was leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Suu Kyi was previously held under house arrest by military leaders for 15 years. For the Biden administration, the situation in Myanmar has quickly turned into one of its most pressing international challenges. Today, the State Department announced they'll be reviewing U.S. aid to the government of Myanmar and making cuts to that aid in response to the coup. Joining me now to discuss is Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nihal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what led to the coup?
Well, there was an election in November in Myanmar, and the civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi, her party did very, very well. And the military-backed party did not do as well. And apparently the military leadership was unhappy with this. They made some allegations of election fraud, and they decided to stage this coup before the newly elected parliament was set to convene on Monday.
Now, you're talking about a military that's suggesting that there was election fraud. Election fraud is something we heard about often in this country. Was there any sort of, you know, are those two things connected? Were they inspired by the narrative of election fraud? Do we know?
It's very difficult to know exactly what was going into their thinking. I would be hesitant, though, to say that Myanmar necessarily takes moves based on what the U.S. president or what the United States does or events here. So it's not a connection that I am willing to make without some better proof.
So let's talk a little bit about Aung San Suu Kyi, because she is also a controversial figure because of her failure to condemn violence against Rohingya Muslims. Tell us a little bit more about her situation.
Well, you know, she's the civilian leader, the de facto leader of the country. She spent 15 of 21 years under house arrest because she was advocating for democracy in Myanmar, which was long ruled by a military junta. And since her party won elections in 2015, she's done what she can to run the country despite the military controlling significant levers of power. Right now, what we're hearing, we know she's detained. It's a little unclear exactly where she is. There's some reports to say that she is under house arrest again, but it's not entirely certain. And one question that I've been trying to get answered is whether the Biden administration has been trying to reach her. I do know that U.S. military officials have been trying to contact their Burmese counterparts, but I don't know what's come of that.
Nihal, what was the Trump administration's approach to Myanmar, particularly the violence against Rohingya Muslims?
Well, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson declared what was happening an ethnic cleansing, and he also visited Myanmar to kind of make the point that they needed to stop mistreating the Rohingya this way. Secretary of State Pompeo oversaw basically a review of exactly what had happened to the Rohingya, but he never actually made a formal declaration that a genocide had occurred. He kind of held off on that. And you know, my understanding is partly it was because, you know, there was a concern that if you call it a genocide, the military in Myanmar would be more angry with the U.S. and further turn toward China, and the U.S. would lose influence. The other thing that the administration, the Trump administration, did was they did impose a lot of sanctions on individual military leaders who they held responsible for the atrocities against the Rohingya. President Trump himself, though, he didn't very much pay attention to what was happening in Myanmar. I know that he spoke of it only twice. One was behind closed doors as part of a speech, and it was only a brief reference. And another time, it was when he was introduced to a Rohingya man in the Oval Office, and the guy said, I'm Rohingya. And the president's reaction was, where is that? So it was clear that he wasn't particularly paying attention. But there were a lot of people in the Trump administration who did care and who did try to do what they can to impose some costs on the issue.
We know that President Trump right now is an impeachment trial is about to begin in the upcoming days about whether or not the president himself incited part of the insurrection that we witnessed on the Capitol. We now see members of the GOP, Nihal, who initially spoke out against what the president may have done to incite this insurrection, are now sort of walking that back. And at the same time, they're critiquing what they see happening in Myanmar. Does the United States have a leg to stand on? I mean, after 4 years of Donald Trump, how much could that have affected our standing internationally to call out these atrocities?
It's not great right now, U.S. credibility on democracy, but it's also an opportunity for the Biden administration. And it's going to be interesting to see if they try to seize it. They already are in touch with international allies. They're issuing strong statements. And so to them, it's a way to say, look, America is back. Trump was an aberration. The U.S., of course, stands for democracy and human rights. And we want you to work with us. Now, what I think is going to be interesting is whether our allies come in a unified way and actually stand with us to the degree that they could. And then that when that comes, you know, you have to think about their interests and their relations with places like China and Myanmar itself. So it's not going to be simple.
Let's talk about that relationship between China and Myanmar and how that could affect the U.S. response.
Right. Well, China, you know, has long been Myanmar's biggest trading partner. U.S. trade with Myanmar is not very much. China, you know, has had a relationship with the military and to some degree with the civilian leadership. It's their neighbor. It also, it's also is affected by the unrest in Myanmar. So it wants stability because there's all sorts of fighting along its border with ethnic minorities and the Myanmar military. It really is a very complicated relationship. So on the one hand, you know, they have so far they've called the coup, the Chinese, they've called the coup a major cabinet reshuffle. And they're very much trying to downplay it. At the same time, the Myanmar military, they're not necessarily like eager to like be vassals of the Chinese. One of the reasons that they decided to allow for democratization was because they wanted to get out of the grip of the Chinese a bit and to have more Western connections. So it's a little too simplistic to say, oh, this is definitely China's territory now. But it is definitely in terms of authoritarianism and promoting dictatorship and stuff. It's a point in China's corner.
Nahal Tusi is a foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Nahal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As the number of COVID-19 cases has surged across the U.S. this winter, doctors, nurses, and other first responders have been stretched thin. But so has another less recognized group of people, the so-called last responders. And those are the people working in our nation's funeral homes, morgues, crematories, and more. And they've played a vital role in the pandemic since the first wave of COVID-19 last spring, rethinking how we honor and care for the dead in this age of physical distancing and Zoom memorials. Almost a year after the worst of that first wave descended on the United States, we're checking in with two of these last responders, one in Southfield, Michigan, and one in Los Angeles, California. Stephen Kemp is the director of Kemp Funeral Home and Cremation Services and a spokesperson for the National Funeral Directors Association. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Caitlin Doty is the co-owner of Clarity Funerals in Los Angeles and host of the YouTube series Ask a Mortician. Caitlin, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, Caitlin, you're based in LA where COVID-19 deaths are surging. Tell us what that's meant for you and the work that you do.
It's meant everything. It's been a complete, almost violent upheaval in how we work. You know, we watched in horror with what happened with this amount of bodies and deaths in April in places like Detroit, in places like New York City. And we really thought that in the ensuing months, if it did come to Los Angeles, if cases did surge in that way, that there was going to be a plan in place with the government, with first responders. And come mid-December and continuing until now, there just hasn't been a plan. It's been almost a mass fatality situation, and it's been all up to these small private funeral homes to step up and take care of the dead. And it's completely upheaved everything that we do and how we handle death and how we arrange funerals and really how we're able to lovingly and helpfully serve the families.
Stephen, when you hear Caitlin describing this, and I'm thinking back to a personal experience where someone I know had passed away from COVID-19 and their family went to at least 10 different funeral homes before finding one that would accept her body. When you hear stories like that, when you hear stories like Caitlin, how is your experience similar or different in Detroit?
My experience in Detroit, I'm just north of Detroit. I'm actually connected to Detroit and I'm just a couple of miles north of Detroit. But in March and April, it seemed to hit our community, and mainly what we're talking about is minority community. My community in Southfield is made up of Korean, Chaldean, African-American, white. So it is a melting pot of all the ethnicities. And I was one of the hottest zip codes in the state of Michigan. There were basically three zip codes that the COVID deaths were rampant. And I was in Oakland, Southern Oakland County, where it was the highest in our entire county. It was almost surreal. I mean, it was 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. And the phone never stopped ringing. I thought it was a call center. And there really was no consistent plan to address the number of deaths that were happening. We had hospital morgues overflowing. We had medical examiner offices overflowing. Removal services couldn't do what they could do. And because of executive orders, the clerk's offices were closed. So we couldn't file any paperwork to get a disposition of the human remains. Consequently, remains were piling up here at the funeral home. I had to rent a 30-foot refrigerated trailer. So it almost just like our other caller said, said that we almost had to triage everyone. And luckily through MFDA, our local association, we were able to get some things done and get some help in here through other directors who pitched in to help us because we were just getting inundated. And there was really no solution that really came from government. It was almost like we were on our own in this kind of thing.
And Caitlin, that's sort of what you're describing, that the lack of a government, a strong government partnership, a strong government response, because most of this industry is privatized.
It is. And that's been the history of the American funeral industry in the 20th century. But I echo everything that he is saying. It's exactly what is happening here. But it happened where he was 10 months ago at this point. And I think it was naive of me to expect that we would have learned something. And by we, I mean mass fatality groups. I mean the California governor's office. We knew that Los Angeles is a densely situated area with a large minority population. Most of the deaths we are seeing at my funeral home are Latino and Black, and they know that they live in multi-generational homes, and a lot of them are lower income and don't have the option to not work and to not go to work and not to go outside the home and potentially bring COVID back to the home. And they knew these things well in advance and that we were potentially vulnerable. But for the last month and a half, as this has just been getting worse and worse, as he said, as the phone just does not stop ringing, I'm looking around and going, where is the help here? And the expectation, and I've talked to people in the California governor's office who basically echo this, the expectation is that because hospitals, quote unquote, don't have a choice whether or not people die there, they are getting all of the refrigerated storage and all of the help. And because funeral homes are private businesses and we do have the choice whether or not to help people, we have to step up as private businesses and provide this refrigeration ourselves. And that's nice in theory, but one, it's almost impossible to permit that, especially if you're a smaller funeral home, a place to keep all of these people. And second, the places that do have the money to bring in huge refrigerated storage in some place like Los Angeles are going to be these larger funeral homes, corporate funeral homes, who charge anywhere from, you know, $4,000 up to $15,000 for a simple cremation or burial.
Stephen, one of the things that we're talking about is first responders a lot during this and essential workers during this pandemic. And you all are considered essential workers and often on the front lines. Do you think that funeral staff and funeral homes have been treated as such? Have you all been given vaccine priority, for example, or the PPE resources that you need to do the jobs that you're doing?
Well, initially in March and April, when the surge happened with us, the PPE was a huge problem. My suppliers were out of everything. There was I couldn't get disinfectant. I couldn't get anything from suppliers at all because the general public was buying up what we use every day. The hospitals were having the same issue. In terms of vaccines, that's one of my pet peeves because they seem to have forgotten about us. If you didn't know, my wife, my son, and I all had COVID in March. My wife and I were isolated for 2 weeks because we were exposed and were positive for COVID. Now with vaccines, it's almost like we're forgotten. In some areas, it is spotty. Some areas, vaccines that we're given 1A with the first responders. In my state, we're considered 1B group C, which puts us under people under 65. So they're, with the limited amount of vaccines that we haven't even been contacted or called or anything, and we're exposed to it every single day. If not from the human remains, it's actually from the families who've been exposed to it, who actually come into our office expose us inadvertently, but often them have been quarantined or we're in the household with the remains and the people who have been exposed to them. So I think that we have been forgotten. And I feel a little bit of resentment towards it. And you know, I've really tried to make my voice heard in terms of government and us being considered first responders, even though we're last. We're the end healthcare professionals who take care of these people. We, you know, if nobody's there to pick up human remains, then where would we be? So consequently, I think that's important.
I'm sorry that your family had to deal with the COVID-19 infection, Stephen. Caitlin, in addition to what Stephen's describing as the health and safety elements here, there's also a mental health effect that this has to have. With the understanding that you're both funeral professionals here, the enormity and the amount of bodies of the deceased that you're both describing, I wonder if that has had an effect on the mental health of funeral directors and providers. Caitlin.
Absolutely. It's a complete shift. You know, we are funeral directors, but we are not mass fatality experts. We are not used to coming in and cremating or burying this sheer amount of bodies. And I think where the real sadness comes in is, like Stephen said, the phone never stops ringing. And we just don't have the resources. We've had to turn people away. And having to turn away these families that are sobbing, begging you, saying, please, my dad has been here. This is the 15th funeral home we've called. Please come pick him up. Can someone help us? And to say, not only can we not help you, but there's just no one to help you. I don't know any other funeral homes that can pick up right now. Or I don't know, there's no government line that you can call for someone to help you. That really takes its toll. And you notice it, you know, we call around to do our jobs, to file these paperwork, to get them cremated or buried. And everyone from the doctors to the coroner's office to the nurses in the hospitals, everyone is doing their absolute best, but you can just hear the quiver in their voices as they attempt to hold it together every day. And I mean, the biggest thing, though, is the families of these people who have died and don't have support from their community because they're isolated, and their government because they're not stepping up. And I think we don't know yet what the long-term consequences are going to be.
Stephen, how has the pandemic changed the way you do your job? We know that doctors, for example, and ICU professionals are now having to, you know, use phones to Zoom or FaceTime with family members in many ways. So how has it affected how you do your job?
Pretty significantly, in that, praise the Lord, I have, you know, we've prepared here because we're pretty new. I built the facility about 3 years ago, so we were already equipped with Zoom and webcasting technology. But we really had to put that into effect in our website. So we had to update our websites to make virtual showrooms. Use Zoom almost every day in meeting with families or Skype or any other electronic. And the phone is changed. It changed our business tremendously because now we can't even have funerals. We only have 25 people. And that varies. We go from 10 to 0 to 25 to 20% of volume. It all depends on what the death rate is and the COVID infection rate is that particular week. So we're getting differing regulations from our state government. So we have to adapt almost daily to whatever, you know, our governor is trying to keep us safe. I support her 100%, but it's been challenging. So everything now is virtual. And families, you know, we don't touch the families. Most of the families we serve, we know personally, they're friends. And you're being unable to see them, and they were unable to see them in the hospital. If they're having a cremation and there's no prep work, they can't see them in before cremation. All we have to do is show them a picture. It has really been very tough on the families and my staff. We need a mental break from all this. And thank goodness our rate is decreased somewhat this first quarter of 2021.
Caitlin, we've got a minute left. Is there something that the federal government should do? We know that they've added some money for funerals related to COVID-19 in the December stimulus package, but what else in about a minute?
It's starting to move. There is the new stimulus, which I hope people are going to be able to easily and clearly access for funeral funds. They have activated the DMORT, which is the Disaster Mortuary Operations Relief Team, although I think that's going to be more focused on the coroner's office. We need help for the families and smaller funeral homes when it comes to refrigeration and when it comes to costs, because these lower income families cannot bear the costs of a large, elaborate funeral home. This is something that the government needs to step in on. There's no, what better example of people who need relief than people who are still dying en masse from COVID in these lower income Black and Brown areas.
Caitlin Doty is the co-owner of Clarity Funerals in Los Angeles, and Stephen Kemp is the director of Kemp Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Southfield, Michigan, and a spokesperson for the National Funeral Directors Association. Stephen and Caitlin, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm at Tanzina Vega. We can also take your voice memos. You can record those on your phone and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or call us at 877-8MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253 and leave us your take there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.